From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. This afternoon in the Rose Garden, President Biden and congressional Democrats celebrate their $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief deal, which Biden signed into law yesterday. It will provide cash payments to most Americans starting as soon as this weekend.
In his primetime address last night, President Biden directed states to open vaccinations to all adults by May 1st. That's earlier than expected. And he said if Americans remain vigilant and stop the spread of the coronavirus, small groups of people should be able to hang out with each other on the 4th of July.
I will not relent until we beat this virus. But I need you, the American people. I need you. I need every American to do their part. And that's not hyperbole. I need you.
For more, let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable guests. Eugene Daniels is a political White House correspondent and co-author of The Political Playbook. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I am well. Thanks for being here. And Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Hey, Scott.
Hey, guys. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I know, right? So the president's speech last night started off pretty somber, but as the night went on, he gave very specific markers that Americans should aspire to if we want to actually get through this thing. Scott, what were some major takeaways for you?
Definitely. You know, one that everyone should, all American adults should have the ability to get vaccinated by May 1st. That was obviously significant. And secondly, this idea giving Americans hope that they can gather with small groups of their family and friends for the July 4th celebration, something that we've all been longing for months and months. And I think the president is, you know, doing this sort of balancing act. He's encouraging people to get vaccinated, to continue to be vigilant with wearing masks, emphasizing that we're not out of the woods yet, especially with all these variants. But he's also giving Americans a glimmer of hope because, let's face it, people are sick and tired of the pandemic, of what it's done to our families. They're emotionally exhausted. And I think for Democrats in the White House, there's a real concern that voters will turn against politicians who continue to be really rigid in advocating for lockdowns and restrictions. And so Americans are looking for, you know, for that light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, Biden was trying to strike this balance.
Eugene, I want to bring you in here. What's your take? There was very much a we can fix it versus former President Trump's I alone can fix it. Do you think that Biden effectively addressed the needs of all American people?
I think the thing that they were trying to make sure they did, and you guys have talked about this, is make sure that he gave people kind of the lowdown on what's happening, but also gave them some things to look forward to. And he's looking back on the more than 500,000 people who've died in this country from COVID-19. And so it's a balance that's, you know, perfect for Joe Biden, who has made his entire career off being kind of like being empathetic with people who are in grief, mostly because of the grief in his own life. He didn't spend a lot of time talking about the policy of this COVID relief bill, right? So he made sure not to open himself up to critiques that this was all about politics. And this focus on what people can do soon, as long as we get together, it's completely different than what we heard from the last 4 years with President Trump, almost at tenfold, especially because, you know, we haven't had a lot of speeches from President Biden. The media has been asking when he's going to do a press conference, and they've been doing what a lot of White Houses have done. They hold their star player for big moments like this, right? And that's exactly what we saw. It gave it this sense of gravitas, and I think they also wanted to give it a sense of history that they felt it deserved.
You know, before we move on from this, I want to bring up one other note. The president spoke out against a rise in attacks on Asian Americans during the pandemic. Let's listen.
They're forced to live in fear for their lives just walking down streets in America. It's wrong, it's un-American, and it must stop.
Scott, how notable was it for a U.S. president to acknowledge one of the continual hate crimes that critics believe bore out of former President Trump's blaming of the virus on China?
Yeah, what a 360-degree turn from President Trump, who actually just this week issued yet another statement calling the coronavirus the China virus in a written statement. President Biden obviously has made these hate crimes and the anti-Asian rhetoric a priority of his administration. And it goes hand in hand with some of the legislation we're seeing on Capitol Hill from Congresswoman Grace Meng and Senator Mazie Hirono, who have a new hate crimes bill that provides more resources and makes it easier for local communities to report hate crimes that are related to COVID-19 and some of this anti-Asian rhetoric we're seeing.
Hmm. Eugene, why don't we shift gears here and talk about that relief bill. Starting next week, Biden and his surrogates are going to start a multi-state campaign to try to sell the new COVID package. Really, it starts today when Biden is in the Rose Garden. But how important is it, do you think, that Democrats get out there and try to control the narrative on this bill?
I think for them it's one of the most important parts about this bill, now that it's signed and now that things are happening. President Biden was vice president in 2009, and he's talked about how that President Obama, his former boss, should have sold his own stimulus bill in a different way. And I think they have an easier way to do this. This is a bill that isn't going to auto companies. This isn't going to big banks. This is going to people's pockets, right? You have $1,400, the most money that anybody has gotten during this entire pandemic, going into people's pockets. They need to get out front and own that. And especially the fact that there were no Republican votes on this, the thing that you're probably going to see from not just Biden Harrison, but also most importantly, their surrogates all over television, different ads that we're going to start seeing, is that the Democrats did this. The Democrats put all this money in your pockets, and it's really popular, right? This bill is in the 60s and 70s consistently. They also have to make sure that they, when it rolls out, the benefits roll out correctly. There's not a lot of administrative issues. And so the balance between those things is really important. But the PR, as you know, we're talking politics, and the PR of that is huge.
Yeah, Scott, what about Republicans? Because here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi slamming them because not a single one voted for the bill.
Unfortunately, Republicans, as I say, vote no and take the dough. You see already some of them claiming, oh, this is a good thing or that's a good thing, but they couldn't give it a vote.
Eugene kind of hinted at this. How successful will Republicans be trying to attack this bill as, rampant liberal overspending when it is pretty popular with the American public, at least so far?
Right. And Republicans who I spoke to on Capitol Hill this week say that the 2022 election is a long time away. Yes, there are certain provisions, including those $1,400 stimulus checks that are very popular right now. But they say wait until the fall of 2022. They're betting that that spending and fiscal issues and debt and deficits will be an issue that voters care about, in a year and a half from now, when both the House and Senate will be up for election, and when Republicans believe they have a real shot at taking back those two majorities, which are very slim majorities at the moment, in favor of Democrats. And so they're playing the longer game. It's still, these provisions are still very critical and important and popular. But Republicans believe that the more and more we learn about some of these provisions that are in the bill, and we are actually still learning some of the details, that voters will be turning against some of the other provisions, in the coming months and into 2022.
I want to ask you guys.
Scott,
yes. Yeah.
Just to add to what Scott was saying, the Republicans are going to work on doing that. But the difference is, as opposed to 2009, for example, their party is different. And the caring about the deficit, that isn't exactly how the last 4 years, the 4 years of the Trump presidency went, right? It was not something that former President Trump really cared that much about. And they passed their own, high tax cut bill. And a lot of that went to people who had, the top percents of this country. And so I think Republicans are going to have to contend with the fact that the base doesn't actually seem to care that much about the deficit, even if now on Capitol Hill they've kind of found their religion again after the last 4 years.
Hmm. All right. Well, listen, I want to play one more piece of tape here, and this is all of the living ex-presidents, except Donald Trump, were in an ad urging people to get vaccinated. Let's listen.
I'm getting vaccinated because we want this pandemic to end as soon as possible.
So we urge you to get vaccinated when it's available to you.
So roll up your sleeve and do your part.
This is our shot.
Now it's up to you.
So, Scott, where has former President Trump been this week of during this, you know, a lot of big Biden moments?
We really have not seen too much of Trump. We've seen some statements from the president. These are written statements that sort of resemble tweets. But as we know, he has been banned from Twitter. He continues to be banned from Twitter. And so we haven't seen or heard from him too much.
Well, Scott, we got to leave it there. Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, and Eugene Daniels, Politico White House correspondent and co-author of Politico Playbook. Thanks to you both.
The Black Lives Matter movement gained prominence after the 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And since then, it has spread to hundreds of cities throughout the nation. A new study published in the Social Science Research Network finds that in most places where we see regular BLM demonstrations, the number of killings by police has gone down in comparison to cities with no BLM protests. The study analyzed data on police killings nationwide from 2014 to 2019. And to parse all of this out, let's bring in the author of this study, Travis Campbell. He's an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and Travis, we want to be clear, correlation is not causation. But what can we draw from your study?
I think the study makes it clear that the protests are having a sizable impact on lethal use of force by the police, and that places that have protests experience a 15 to 20% drop in lethal use of force below what we would have expected from the trend in lethal use of force in those places before the protests started, and comparing the trend in places that never had protests.
And can you describe briefly the methodology used? A 20% difference in police killings is really stark. I mean, how did you come up to this number?
My study uses what's called a difference in difference design by sorting cities into a treated and control group. So in this case, the treated group would be places with protests and the control group would be places without protests. And then comparing the trend in the outcome, lethal use of force, before and after the onset of the protests between the two groups.
What are some of the through lines here that you think? What change did the protests spark in these communities?
So I find evidence of three main explanations. The first is their local police become much more likely to obtain body cameras and also expand some community policing practices. In addition, I find some evidence consistent with protests reducing community reporting of low-level crimes, and also what's sometimes called a Ferguson effect. Protests increase public scrutiny of the police, and police respond by having lower morale or effort because the police are arresting less people, reducing the number of interactions between the police and civilians, reduce the lethal use of force.
Notably, the data does not include killings and protests from 2020. But did you see protests last summer spread to cities that, according to your research, had never had protests before?
I'm sure that that is the case, but I have not looked at any data from that year. I've been working on this paper for a few years, and I was waiting for some of the crime data and other sources to catch up. And that's why it stopped at 2019. Mm-hmm. So there's been research that has shown that Black Lives Matter protests are more common in cities that lean Democrat. And I haven't seen evidence, but I think anecdotally that places that lean Democrat are also going to be more likely to have more lockdowns due to COVID-19. And in that people go outside less, they might create a spurious reduction in lethal use of force.
That makes sense. You've been studying this for a couple of years, as you mentioned. What made you interested in really parsing out this data?
So given the size and persistence of the Black Lives Matter movement, I find the lack of rigorous research on the topic extremely surprising. To solve a lot of the issues, we need to have an honest conversation about both the benefits and the costs of this social movement and how the police should respond and the impact it's having on local communities.
That was Travis Campbell, an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, on his new study that found police killings decreased in communities that saw Black Lives Matter protests from 2014 to 2019. Travis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, after the killing of George Floyd, we also saw support for the Black Lives Matter movement swell. At its height in June, more than 67% of Americans polled by Pew Research said they were in support of BLM, with millions of people around the world taking to the streets in support. We wanted to see what has been born out of some of those movements in our nation. So we checked in with BLM organizers in Mississippi, Ohio, and Seattle. And that's where we'll start, with Sakara Remu, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Seattle King County. With the support of mostly Democratic lawmakers, the focus on BLM there has been to craft several police accountability bills currently up before the legislature.
Lawmakers were paying attention when everything went down last year, and they did not wait. They started working immediately in drafting bills. Community started drafting bills. So when we came in to the legislature with six focus areas for the whole of Black life, we started with 150 bills. Most of them are still alive. Our priorities are about 70. Our top tier priorities are about 15 bills, representing more than $500 million for Black people.
The bills up for consideration include limiting the use of tactics like neck restraints and creating a separate office to investigate the use of deadly force. Remu says it's the first time in a long time that she's seen a collective effort from BLM activists, community members, and lawmakers working together for a more equitable future in Washington state. There's even been some support from law enforcement. This week, the Washington Council of Police and Sheriffs, a broad coalition of law enforcement unions, wrote a letter to the legislature, urging them to continue their work on police accountability for this legislative session.
This is movement leaders who have been working in policy for decades, who were also in the streets protesting. We're all the same people. It is our lawmakers who get it, and it's also the greater diversification of our legislature. We have more Black and brown, more women in the legislature, and it is community statewide that is making these things happen.
That was Sakara Remu, who is co-founder of Black Lives Matter Seattle King County and lead strategist for the Washington Black Lives Matter Alliance. Well, last summer proved to be the beginning of the BLM movement in Mississippi. The group is now made up of individuals throughout the state focusing on police accountability and mentorship. Reginald Virgil is a Black Lives Matter leader from Gulfport, Mississippi, and I asked him about the start of his organization and the issues they're tackling.
Last year, we became established over the summer, and then from there we grew and we worked with other communities. First and foremost, as Black Lives Matter Mississippi, we're definitely not anti-police. We're just anti-police brutality. When we work with the community and we talk to the community, of course, it would be good to strengthen that relationship between police officers and the Black community.
And thinking about this more broadly, though, I mean, it speaks also to some of the challenges culturally that you still deal with in the state of Mississippi.
In Mississippi, there's this nuance of racist behavior, you know, overtly, covertly. It's within the laws, it's within the policies. And that's why it's almost inescapable unless we can get the right leadership elected to take charge and change these things so Mississippi can progress, not only with the flag or with statues, but as a people.
BLM is new there in Mississippi. As you said, really, you're not even a year old. Are you hopeful for the future with all of this laying before you, but also a groundswell of support that you're seeing like never before?
Yes, we are hopeful. One thing that we are consistent with is educating our Black youth, and we started a mentorship program, partner with universities and with professionals. The kids can learn about government as they did this past month. They also learn about their African culture, tradition, storytelling from a historian, Tuskegee man. And it's good to see that, to bring everyone together.
Reginald Virgil, a leader with the Black Lives Matter movement, Mississippi, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, and thank you a lot as well.
In Cleveland, Ohio, Kareem Hinton is focused on using media to deepen BLM's relationship with communities in Cleveland. Hinton is an organizer and co-founder of Black Lives Matter Cleveland. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, so many of us immediately think about Tamir Rice when we think about some of the work of BLM there. A reminder for listeners, in 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was playing outside with a toy gun when a police officer shot and killed him. And the Justice Department ended their 5-year inquiry into his death just this last December, and the officers involved will not face federal charges. What's the work been like to build trust and accountability between Cleveland communities and the police?
One of the things that you can really look back to is some of the footage of the chief as well as the mayor. They did not agree with all of the findings of the Department of Justice, but they said that they would comply. You know, it's sort of like a person who's trying to seek help with regards to addiction. You know, they say that first you have to admit that you have a problem. Mm. And up to this point, the city nor Cleveland police have admitted that they have a problem.
You've launched a crowdfunding campaign for a documentary series called The State of Injustice, focused on examining police injustices in Ohio. And this is an evolution of on-the-street protests and legislative action. What are some key issues that are on your agenda as we move forward through this year?
Really, it's painting a complete picture. What this series is able to do is to show the complicity of not only the rank and file officers, you know, that contribute to the problematic cultures that exist within law enforcement agencies, but also the administration, the mayors, because, you know, they have more powers than they wish to let on. So we're hoping to show that it is actually a systemic issue that is not just in our region, not just in our state, but around the world and around the country.
Kareem Hinton, organizer and co-founder of Black Lives Matter Cleveland, thank you so much for talking with us.
Once again, thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Hearing loss is a fact of life for many humans, but not for fish, reptiles, or birds.
People noticed in chickens that they could take them to, say, a heavy metal concert, blast the ears really to oblivion, and then within days, new hair cells would begin to sprout.
The science of sound. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package is a done deal. But thanks to an Obama-era law, it could set the stage for another battle in Congress over cuts to Medicare and other popular programs. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Thank you.
Sure. Can you explain why there would be budget cuts at the same time the government is spending trillions of dollars more on COVID relief?
Yeah, so the issue is something called PAYGO. You think of it as pay as you go. It's an act that corrects for additions to the federal deficit. It was brought in many years ago, the idea being that if you do something that has long-term negative effects on the deficit or increase the deficit over time, it automatically pulls back funding from certain departments and programs. Mm-hmm. And what Republicans in Congress are now doing is they want to invoke that to argue against the impact of this the stimulus bill, saying it'll, you know, raise the deficit by $1.9 trillion over a decade. That's how we price it. That's why we call it a $1.9 trillion bill. So they want to now think about cutting back on other programs in order to make up for that so that the net effect on the deficit is not an increase.
I see. So to rein in federal spending, Medicare would face a $36 billion cut under PAYGO, but that's not the only popular program we're talking about. If you're getting a student loan, for example, you might feel this, or if you're a farmer with a government subsidy.
Yep. There would actually, so $36 billion would be Medicare, but there are another $345 billion in cuts that would come from other areas that are currently called mandatory federal spending, which, you know, they don't involve annual appropriations from Congress. They just automatically get increased. So things like student aid, you mentioned, housing programs, investor protection programs, state unemployment programs. The reductions generally amount to a few million dollars or less for each of these line items, but there are a lot of them. Now, what's not included, what wouldn't get cut due to PAYGO, are Social Security, Medicaid, and food stamps. Those are exempted from cuts. But as a result of those exemptions, there are some things that may be cut very, very deeply.
I see. Well, it takes 60 votes in the Senate to stop these cuts. So every Democrat plus 10 Republican senators. Do you think Democrats have those votes, or are there other options?
This is a tricky one. These days, it takes 60 votes kind of to get anything done in the Senate. The House would probably override the cuts. It would remain to be seen whether the Senate would do it, partially because the question is the calculus about whether it makes sense for these senators to do it versus, you know, just sort of standing in the way of legislation that they didn't vote to support. There were no Republicans who supported to vote. They didn't support this $1.9 trillion bill, so it may be a continuation of their opposition to it.
All right. Well, I still have you. The new relief bill includes a third round of stimulus payments, $1,400 checks for many Americans, plus even more for families with kids. How soon are those payments going to go out?
Some of them will go out as early as this weekend. If people have automatic deposit, if they got their 2019 or 2020 refunds deposited into their account, they will start going out this weekend. If you're getting a physical check, it will take longer. You mentioned the child provisions, child support provisions. That's actually a really big deal. There are estimates that it might reduce child poverty in this country by up to 40%. So it's not the most well-known part of the bill. It may be the most impactful over time.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Peter.
The Grammys are this weekend, and the most anticipated part of music's biggest night is the announcement of one of the night's biggest awards. Eight artists, including Taylor Swift and Post Malone, are in the running for Album of the Year. And one artist on the list you may or may not have heard of is Jacob Collier. There's a funky feeling in my bones, in my bones, in my bones. I got that funky feeling. The 26-year-old from England has been called a lot of things, a music phenom, a jazz prodigy. Well, now this year, Collier is also a three-time Grammy-nominated artist for his 2020 album titled Jesse, Volume 3. And Jacob Collier joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
Yes. So you're not new to the Grammy-winning club. You've got two from 2017 and another two last year, all for Best Arrangements. But this year, you're up for one of the biggest awards of the night, as I said. How does that feel?
It feels utterly surreal, if I'm being completely honest. It feels like a kind of change in the waters, I suppose. And it's never something I ever really imagined. You know, I've always focused on making music that I want to hear and makes me happy. And I've been sponging up all sorts of different musical influences and different sounds and genres from all over the world since I was very, very small. My dream was, imagine how colourful it could sound, how joyous it could sound. And so I think that I really focused my energy on the creating of the music. And I almost started having a music career by accident because I started to share these worlds, these sounds I was making online. And the whole thing kind of picked up steam. But honestly, an Album of the Year nomination is bananas. But it's very, very exciting.
Yeah. Well, let's get to your music. Jesse, Volume 3 is the third part of a four-part work. And the collection has been described as representing different parts of the day. So which part of the day is Volume 3?
Yeah, I guess I started dreaming up this quadruple album about 2 years ago or so. And my goal was really to make these four different spaces within which different sort of genres, different sound worlds could be explored. And so Jesse Volume 1 is the first volume, which is very vast, I suppose, almost orchestral, you could say. And there are orchestral musicians on that record too, and choirs and things like that. And then Jesse Volume 2 is more of a sort of a folk space. I like to think of it as a smaller acoustic space where songs can live. And then what Jesse Volume 3 was always very exciting to me about was the fact that it was going to explore some of the more electronic sounds, digital manipulation within the pop sphere or the R&B sphere. And then Jesse Volume 4 was this kind of blank that I left until this moment where I get to kind of figure out what's important to me enough to put on the album. And one of the challenges and joys throughout the creation process as the producer of the album and the composer and stuff has been to work with so many of my favorite musicians on the planet. There's about 30 or 40 collaborators spread across all four albums, from choirs and orchestras to Northumbrian pipes players to rock guitar legends to R&B singers, hip-hop artists, rappers and trappers and folk fiddlers. And I've always been a bit of a shapeshifter, and I've enjoyed the process of seeing these ideas come to life over the last few years.
Okay, we've got to get to your shape-shifting, but we also need to just take people through a journey of Jesse Volume 3 with a couple of pieces. Let's start with Time Alone With You, featuring Daniel Caesar.
All night, star bright, shines down on me. So good, so bright, you're all I see.
And from here, we're going to go right into Sleeping on My Dreams.
Don't think I'm lost without your wings. Ah, ah, I've been sleeping on my dreams. Ah.
So I imagine we were playing a game. Something like you could be an animal and all I had to do was be tame.
And now let's go to All I Need, featuring Mahalia and Ty Dolla $ign, which earned you a nomination for Best R&B Performance.
Cause every time I think about it, can't stop thinking about it. Can't stop thinking. You were all I need.
You were all I need. Oh.
So I'll be singing in the starlight.
I mean, come on. This music is so joyful. I heard some neo-soul, some electric R&B, a little jazz, some pop. Mm. There's a lot of risk-taking and genre bending that you do. How do you know when you've created the perfect balance in a song?
I like to follow my goosebumps. When I get goosebumps, I feel like I've done something right. And in some ways, you can overthink very easily what's good. And everybody, no matter who you are, everyone's going to have a different version of what good is. And you know, for artists now in the 21st century, with the amount that's possible within music, I think one of the challenges is how do you fit together a sort of mosaic that feels the best to you? Because if music feels the best to you as an artist, then you've kind of done as much as you can. And so I guess for me, you know, I've been amassing all these different flavors for quite some time. And in the creation of them, I begin to understand them slightly better.
Your first shot into the musical stage, you brought this up, was through social media back in 2013. You were just 19 years old and you posted a video on YouTube of yourself performing your own arrangement of an all-time favorite Stevie Wonder song. Let's listen.
Don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, baby. Cause I'll be standing on the side when you're checking out.
And this was a game changer for you because it got a lot of attention of some of the most iconic names in music. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'd been making YouTube videos for about a year or two by that point, and I'd fallen in love with this process of arranging, which is basically where you take a song that exists already, and then you kind of twist it up and make it into something that is brand new. And it was a really crazy moment because I put this cover up, and the next day, you know, it had about 100,000 views, and I had emails from so many of my heroes, you know, people like Quincy Jones and Herbie Hancock, and my mind was just completely blown. It was kind of the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that. And it really came out of the blue.
I can just imagine how you felt. I mean, you're sitting at your computer and you get a message from Quincy Jones.
I know. Are you kidding me? It's wild.
Yeah. He actually said, he told Billboard, it was apparent that this kid's understanding of music theory, melody, harmony, and improvisation was exactly where it needed to be. What a huge compliment. I mean, what have you learned from him?
He is such a maverick. And he's almost like a gentle giant to me. I think he's so focused on the human connection of music and what's possible when you bring people together from all over the world. And he often talks about the balance between science and soul, I suppose, and how to make sure that you kind of understand how these different ingredients fit together in high resolution as a musician so that you can whittle your creations using these forces that make sense, but also that there's a bunch of soul in it and that you bring yourself to that table. And, you know, you're not afraid to use your imperfections, your strangeness, your imagination, really to stretch that and to tell the most compelling stories that you can.
Artists like Quincy Jones and really you, who shapeshift in this way, are pretty rare. How do you keep yourself whole? How do you keep yourself maybe unencumbered from the messages that you hear from the industry to be a certain way or to fit a certain category?
It's a really good question. I think that the music industry is one of many industries that has the kind of tendency to close people down a little bit and to make them containable. Because I think that when people are contained, that they're a bit less of a threat, perhaps, you know, a bit more reasonable. But really, you know, I'm such a staunch non-believer in something like genre. I think genre makes it much easier for the music industry to talk about music and to sell it. But I actually think, you know, from a musician's perspective, genre doesn't help very much. It's a way of degrading something's infinity in a certain kind of way by saying, this is all this is. And actually, you know, I feel like we're in a bit of a shift within music, and it's the era of combining forces rather than defining forces. Mm-hmm. And I think within music, that feels very exciting to be somehow a part of.
And it seems that the audience is very excited by this proposition, too. It's why you're nominated for so many Grammys. As you mentioned, you're now working on this last installation of Jesse. Mm. Can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek on what we can expect from it?
Well, I can't say too much about who's on the album in terms of collaborators, but I am pretty excited about it. And yeah, working with all these musicians that I'm kind of just now coming to know as friends from all sorts of different parts of, especially pop music, actually. And, you know, bringing back the orchestra, bringing back the choirs, and it's going to feel a bit like a celebration of music as a whole, because after all, it is quite joyous that we're even alive at all. And I think if there's one way of really celebrating it in a way that collapses a lot of the borders that we like to put up between us as human beings a lot of the time, I think music can do that. I think it can reach into the hearts of people in a way that nothing else quite can. And I'm going to try and give myself as many, I guess, as many goosebumps as possible. And I can't wait to take the show on the road and to see how the whole thing evolves over the next few years.
Oh, well, I can't wait to celebrate as well. Jacob Collier's latest album, Jesse Volume 3, is nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, including Album of the Year. Thank you so much for taking this time with us.
Thanks for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
After a long pandemic-induced slumber, Las Vegas is coming back to life. MGM recently resumed 24/7 operations at its Vegas resorts. And next week, casinos on the Strip will be allowed to operate at 50% capacity, just in time for spring break. But is it safe? We're joined now by Mario Vargas. He's been a linen attendant at MGM's Mandalay Bay for 19 years. He's also a member of the Culinary Union. Mario, welcome.
Thank you, Peter, and just ask any question.
Yeah, sure. So it was March 3rd when MGM opened up 24/7 operations at your resort. So you've had a few days now to work under those conditions. What's it been like for you?
It's been good. I mean, we've been prepared for this. We've been doing all the requirements, sanitizing, masks, washing hands, social distancing. So we're ready for this.
Yeah. And you're a linen attendant, right? What does that kind of work entail?
Yes, well, we take care of the linen for the guest room attendant. So, like, if I'm working on the swing shift, is to fill the lockers with linen, and on day shift, we take out the soil.
So, from what you can tell from the work you're doing, does it seem like the hotel's filling back up again? Are you busy?
We've been busy. I mean, even when we were 25%, we were busy. We have now more cleaning to do and the sanitizing, and, you know, wearing masks. It's a little hard to work, but the company and the union, they got together and they figured out how to do it better for both of us.
Well, in fact, it seems like they passed a law, or helped pass a law, called the Adolfo Fernandez Bill that was named after a Caesar's Palace porter who died of COVID. Mm-hmm. And it looks like it requires hotels to do extra cleaning, contact tracing, and testing. You talked about some of those things. Do you feel safe, and are the hotels following the rules?
Even before the law, the union was working on getting some type of protection for us, the employees. And so far, the company been working really good with us. You know, I mean, we keep in top, and they provide what we need.
Okay, but you feel safe, right? I mean, because, you know, not only is the hotel now operating 24/7, it's also lifting capacity restrictions. So soon, you're going to be allowed to have it at 50% capacity. That's a lot of people.
Yes, and hopefully more employees. Because we're busy, and you know, it's, to me personally, is to make a habit. Sometimes I go home and I still have the mask for 20 minutes, you know, and I start doing things and I go, oh, I'm home. Something is we don't have, I go to the managers and ask for it, and they'll bring it or they'll tell me where to get it. You know, we're getting good cooperation between both employees and employees.
I'm sure you're also just happy to have your job, because I understand you were laid off.
It was hard. First time laid off in 19 years since I've been in Vegas. And unemployment wasn't that great because there was some kind of problem. The union was helping with that. I was helping people with the unemployment. And out of the blue, after having problems, and then they helped me. So, yeah, I'm glad that I'll be back and just doing the best.
What's your financial situation like now? Because you lost a few months of work there.
I cannot say I'm in the greatest shape, but we were getting food from the union. And then I learned from the past that you cannot just rely on help, that you have to you have to adjust, you know, I mean, with the food, with the bills, not to get into another bill, you know, and there are things that are priority and then other things that can wait. You know, you have a little savings, it's gone, but that help, the little savings that you have on the side.
Have you gotten a vaccine?
No, I'm on the list for it. They'll let me know when will be the next available. But I can't wait to have the vaccine.
Yeah. I mean, I bet it will make you feel quite a bit safer when you go inside that hotel every day.
Oh, yeah, but I'm still going to be wearing masks. I'm going to still doing the sanitizing, the cleaning. Information about the vaccine, you know, that was very helpful because without that, there's a lot of people that, you know, they are confused and they don't have too much trust on it. But with the training that we got with the 226, I'll be able to explain it to some of the coworkers because I'm also a CHOP steward.
All right, Mario Vargas, linen attendant at Mandalay Bay for 19 years. On MGM reopening operations 24/7 at the Las Vegas Strip. Mario, thanks. Good luck to you.
All right. Thank you, Peter. And have a good day.
And by the way, Mario was speaking with us on his lunch break, which was very generous of him. And you know, that same thing happened the last time I spoke with a frontline worker. Back in early February, Seattle grocery store worker Sam Dancy did the interview from the bathroom of his store because the lunchroom was too full. At the time, Sam was waiting for his turn to get a vaccine. And we checked back in with him this morning.
Well, I know since I last spoke to you, I think things have gotten a lot better. Our governor that changed the dates. So he brought the date up to the 22nd of March. And I think I heard just yesterday, it's supposed to be the 17th, that grocery workers are now supposed to have the opportunity to sign up for the shot. So I think the publicity, everything that you guys have done, everything that the union has done, I think it's made things a lot better. So that's the 17th. That's in about 5 days. So what I'm going to try to do, as soon as that opportunity comes around, I'm definitely going to try to sign up and get my shot.
Sam Dancy, about to start his 9-hour shift at a Westwood Village QFC in Seattle. Thanks to him and to everyone working today at grocery stores, hotels, and restaurants around the country. We appreciate you. Stay safe. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR and the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.